Hi, I'm Cameron Wilson. This is Bush Telegraph. You're listening to RN and Radio Australia. Today, why baby boomers could be the saviour for rural Australia. This sometimes maligned group is now seen as being so valuable to the fortunes of the regions that they've even been dubbed super boomers. We'll have more on that today. Also ahead, a man who's dedicated two decades to collecting rabbit and dingo traps, and some more unusual ones too.
Well, we refer to them as man traps because it came from England. There was nothing in England big enough to warrant that size trap, but the English manufacturers did make traps for lions and tigers and, you know, that bigger type of animal.
The man trap, it's about to go on the market. We'll have more on the trap auction coming up today on Bush Telegraph. We start in Queensland, where kangaroo numbers in western Queensland are booming, and it's causing a serious headache for graziers. The drought means kangaroos are now eating pastures that farmers were relying on to feed their sheep and cattle through the dry. In Queensland, the population of the three main species, red kangaroos, eastern grey kangaroos and wallaroos, is now estimated to have reached 33 million last year. Now that's up from 20 million just a couple of years earlier. Stuart McKenzie is witnessing the damage firsthand. Stuart is on Plevna Downs in Erromanga. That's in Queensland. And Ewan Ritchie is also with me, an ecologist from Deakin University. Thank you to both of you for joining us today. Stuart, I'll start with you. How severe is the kangaroo damage on your property?
Cameron, it's not as bad as what it's been in the past. And there's possibly a reason for that, for what we've changed here. But across the region generally, it's not just this year, it's been a constant now for many, many years. And it seems to become at its worst when the drier it gets, it seems to congregate them. And of course, as your pastures get more and more threatened, the roos have more impact. So.
So what are you actually seeing on the property?
Look, here where I am, we actually are seeing, there's quite a number, but it's not plague proportion. Proportions that we've had in the past. A lot of areas we're on towards the far west of Queensland. Further east, they are in plague proportions, and you know, thousands and thousands of roos in particular areas. So yeah, on us, they're moving, and there's still a lot of them, but they're not as bad as they are in areas to our east.
Well, what types of kangaroos are you seeing? What species?
Predominantly red here, red. So
they're the big ones, aren't they?
Yeah, the two species, the reds and the greys, predominantly we get out here. And I'm not talking about the colour of the fur, it's the actual species, because a red species is actually grey coloured often. But yeah, they stand up taller than the greys. And we're on open grass country, and which has always been the domain of the red roos, and the grey roos tend to live in the more timbered country further to our east.
So that hasn't changed too much over the years that you've been on the property?
Yes, there was a change. Back in, going back 5-6 years now, the grey, there's a massive intermingling of those species. So the greys actually moved out into this open country, which was unusual, and the reds moved back into the timbered country, and they just sort of exacerbated the problem as far as population explosions go, I suppose, having species living in areas where they don't normally live.
Okay, so you've still got quite a few on your property at the moment, given the seasonal conditions. But you did mention there that further east they're even worse. Let's just hear from Tambo, from a farmer at Tambo. Now that must be what, maybe 400 kilometres or so from you, is it, Stuart?
A little bit more, about 400 or 500. Yeah,
400 or 500. That'd be the northeast. So the yep. Mick Seymour is from Tambo, and he's saying that the kangaroos are costing him about a third of his income at the moment, and he's counted thousands on his property.
Well, the biggest problem, I had a paddock close to a yard there. It's all improved, blade ploughed, buffalo and sorghum. It was 2,500 acres, and because of my cattle, I got a long trip from up here down there. I thought I'd lock it up, and there was no cattle, just for an easy place to give them a bit of a blow after they got there. And, mate, the kangaroos moved. Once you take cattle out of a paddock down there, the kangaroos move in, and they ate that out within a couple of weeks. Ate it out to nothing.
Can you give us an estimation of what you think the kangaroos are costing you in terms of the kind of amount of pasture that they're eating?
Well, it's quite easy to work out the rate. It'd be about a third. That accounts for a third of the pasture eaten on a property, which is way beyond natural habitat. And, I mean, you take a third away of production country, which money has been spent to plough and seed and everything else, it's a third of income gone.
So what kind of things are you doing to mitigate the roo numbers on your property?
Well, at present I'm not doing anything because I don't believe in just wasting them, going out and shooting them, because one, it's time consuming and you're looking at, you know, dollar odd a bullet and the time that affects, and I don't think you'd have much of an impact on it. They'll just move in.
Mick, you were saying that some of your neighbours have vermin fencing. Are you considering that as an option to controlling the roo problem?
We're thinking very deeply of it. It's about $4,000 a kilometre to do it. And, I mean, today with the returns we're getting for cattle and everything else, you know, you've got to wonder how long you can be viable for.
Tough situation for Mick Seymour there, who's at Tambo, speaking to Lydia Burton. My guest on Bush Telegraph is Stuart McKenzie, and I'll come to you and Richie, ecologist, in just a moment. Stuart, are you hearing similar stories to that from Mick?
Yeah, very much so, Cameron. One story I heard of, and what he's talking about, the cluster fencing that's been happening where people are actually building predominantly dog-proof fencing, but it's also kangaroo fencing around their properties, so either clusters or individual properties. And one area I heard of was 30,000 acres, and they've already shot 17,000 roos out of that area and 46 dingoes, to give you an idea of the sort of populations that, and they haven't finished, so to give you an idea of the sort of populations that are in some of this country.
Serious numbers. Do you see them when you're out and about driving? Are you having to dodge them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing we're doing differently, I suppose, or what I'm seeing here, is that the population are getting back to what I saw that I can still remember sort of 40 years ago, where they were actually lived in mobs, individual mobs, and those mobs were separate as such. There wasn't just a mass swarm of kangaroos wherever you went, which is still happening in a lot of places. So I'm sort of hopeful that what we're doing is actually still having an effect and getting them. I firmly believe, I mean, I'm not a scientist, but I firmly believe that native populations shouldn't naturally get into the overpopulations to the point where they just starve. And not only that they starve and die, but they also completely decimate the natural pastures. So the pastures that they rely on for feed, to the point where I've seen them, you know, digging out the roots of our Mitchell grass plants and destroying a plant that can survive for 50 years or more, which is what they survive on. To me, that goes against the laws of nature. So there's something completely out of balance here.
Yeah, let's find out from a scientist. Dr. Ewan Ritchie's an ecologist at Deakin University. Ewan, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, good morning, Cameron. How are you?
Good. What's going on here? Why are the numbers so great?
Yeah, well, I think Stuart just nailed on the head that the system's out of balance. And I think when we're talking about herbivore populations, there's really two very important things that limit herbivores. One, of course, is food, and that, you know, is grass, and that's affected by rainfall. We've just come off a few good years of rainfall, and obviously now in parts of Queensland we're now back in drought. But the other thing that limits, of course, herbivores is things that eat them, and that's things like dingoes. And so we've got a huge problem in Australia with overabundant herbivores, whether they be kangaroos, whether they be goats, even things like pigs. And what we do know from many parts of Australia now is where we get on top of kangaroo populations, it's usually through dingoes. So I think there's a whole range of issues that we need to think quite carefully now about trying to get on top of kangaroo numbers and actually stopping these booms from occurring, as Stuart just said.
But how many kangaroos can your average dingo take out? It can't be that many.
Well, that's a very interesting question, and it's quite important when we think about it also in terms of kangaroo shooting, because kangaroo shooting, of course, you're targeting the larger males because they have more meat and therefore they're worth a bit more. And you're obviously getting more bang for buck, excuse the pun. But when you're a dingo, of course, they typically are going for the females because they're smaller and they're easier to kill, basically. And if you want to limit a kangaroo population, the quickest way to reduce the kangaroo population is to kill the females, not the males. And that's what dingoes do. So they do a couple of things. Of course, they eat the females, but they also actually cause kangaroos to avoid those areas. If you're a kangaroo and you're hopping around and you all of a sudden start seeing dingoes, you're less likely to actually move into those paddocks and graze there. So dingoes can actually reduce herbivore numbers quite considerably in a number of ways.
Stuart, how close are you to the dingo fence?
We're right on it. It's actually on two, north and south, and north, south and west of our property. So we've had that dog fence there for, whenever it was put up. 30s, I think, or 40s, 1940s. So it's been here for a long time. So we've been inside it for the 77 years that my family's been on this property.
Which means that's changed the dingo activity in the area, clearly.
Yeah, well, interesting the comments by you, and totally agree with the bucks. I mean, what we've done here, we haven't had a roosterer here now for 5 years, and my theory, as a kid, I remember, as I was saying before, I remember the does would all be in one mob with one buck, one big buck, and I'm talking massive animals, and they're getting up to that size again now, and the bucks would all be on their own, like the half size, they'd congregate in their own mobs. And to me, that showed obviously some sort of breeding control. So you had your main buck was looking after his mob of does, and that probably was putting some control on the breeding. Mm. Shooting, of course, as Ewan said, takes out the large ones because they have weight limits and they're trying to get as much meat as possible. And it'd be like the human
that's
population.
That's shooting for harvesting, is it, rather than for pest control that you're talking about?
That's for harvesting, that's right. So you can constantly taking those large males out, and what we were left with was, if you use the comparison with the human population, it'd be like taking everyone out over 20, and you imagine what would happen as far as the breeding and the controls go, and there would be no sort of controls, I would imagine. So, but interestingly, as far as the dingo is concerned, there's no doubt they have an impact, but we've controlled our dingoes for 70-odd years, and the roo populations have still changed dramatically, and I'm putting that down to the predominantly the shooting of the alpha males.
But if when you're shooting under with damage mitigation permits, so that's for vermin control, you wouldn't just necessarily aim for the biggest.
No, that takes everything. But to give you an example, we've done that a couple of times. One was in 1980, another one was in 2002, and we shot in excess or up towards 10,000 kangaroos of every size and shape off basically a 100,000 or 150,000 acre area, and had no negligible effect. They just kept coming in. So once they get to plague proportions, which is what happens when people start taking out pest mitigation permits, they really are so, the populations are that large that they have very little effect.
Ewan, would you agree with that?
Yeah, look, I mean, as I said before, the kangaroo population is booming. We've come off a couple of really big rainfall years, and we don't have anything that's really limiting those kangaroo numbers, that is dingoes. So they can increase dramatically. And as Stuart's saying, you know, you can go and shoot, you know, thousands of kangaroos in a property, but bear in mind, some of these properties are massive. We're talking about properties that are larger than most capital cities in a lot of cases. And you know, most people are only actually obviously shooting from roads or very close to roads where there's access. And there's large areas, therefore, that are not being accessed where kangaroos can just, you know, come back in from. So you're doing very little when you go out and shoot hundreds of, you know, kangaroos in a paddock when you're talking about the size of some of these properties.
How much science is there to back up Stuart's view that you disrupt the mob structure? Is that the correct term?
Yeah, look, that's a really interesting question, and I don't think we have very good information about that to answer that. I mean, there's no question that the large males definitely basically beat up and bully the smaller males and they leave the females alone. I'm not sure whether that actually changes the population size, because you know, what we do know from kangaroos is you don't need many males to do the job, so to speak. So, you know, one male or a few males is probably enough to get most of the females pregnant.
Mm. But this is a similar argument that you hear when it comes to wild dogs sometimes, that targeted
shooting.
Well,
there's a couple of different things going on there. So in case of kangaroos, I think what potentially is going on is, of course, we're shooting all the large males, and that just makes more room available for females. There's more feed for the females, and you end up with a female-biased population. Now, in the case of dingoes, they're really interesting because you can still have dingoes in an area with kangaroos, but that destabilised. So we've baited and we've shot dingoes out from huge areas, and basically what we've ended up with is very young dingoes, sort of 2 years of age or younger, who don't know very much about how to hunt, and so they target things like calves and sheep, and less so kangaroos. And so it gives a false impression that dingoes can't control kangaroos, but what we do know is where dingo packs are stable and have been left alone, they do a very good job of bringing kangaroo numbers right down.
But for the immediate problem at hand for graziers in Queensland, what options do they have then, if you don't believe shooting's the answer?
I think there's a range of solutions. And I think, you know, you mentioned fencing before. And I think fencing's a really, you know, it's a solution at a small scale, but there's huge maintenance costs involved in erecting fences and making sure that kangaroos don't punch holes in them and then you're back to where you started.
And Mick Seymour pointed out many people on the land at the moment are not in a position to fund that.
No, so I don't think fences are going to be a great solution at a large scale. But I think there's a couple of things. You know, we can actually support farmers to use things like guardian animals, which can have two benefits. They can actually keep dingoes away from your livestock, but there's also pretty good evidence they might actually deter kangaroos. And we should also be looking at actually allowing dingoes to come back into some areas. I mean, obviously sheep country, that's not really an option because no one would argue that sheep and dingoes are going to mix very
well.
Not a great
mix, yeah.
They're not.
Yeah.
But in cattle country, that's definitely an option. If you can reduce the impact on calves, and that can be done through, you know, fencing of particular areas or protecting the calves, you know, during that period. So there's a range of things that I think we could do much better to support graziers to reduce the impacts on livestock from dingoes, but also to get on top of kangaroo numbers and even goat numbers in parts of Australia as well.
Yeah, we haven't even touched on goats yet.
Exactly.
Stuart, what are the practical options for you? You've ruled out shooting.
Yeah, look, it's really, we're struggling to find it. I mean, the fencing is becoming more popular. It is very expensive. And as Ewan said, there's a pretty major maintenance issue as well. It is happening in some small areas where groups of properties are getting together and fencing off their area. But particularly for dogs, I mean, the sheep industry is in serious trouble. Up here as far as dogs go, and it is more viable in most places than cattle, especially at the moment. Sheep industry is quite profitable. It is a massive concern, the dogs, and we're not talking dingoes here, we're talking wild dogs, we're talking inbreds, crossbreds, etc. So, and they're actually coming from the east, they're not coming from where we are out in the west, where they're actually dingo purebreds out in the Cooper Creek country and that sort of thing. They're fine, those breeds, but to the west they're the wild dog situation is just becoming worse east of us. As far as the ruse, I honestly believe that there's two issues. There's the macropod harvesting is a very important industry for the smaller country towns in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've been pushing for, and some have been pushing for years, but why take the big bucks? Why not take the does? Because why not take the good eating animal, if you like, the younger animal with the more tender meat, which would change the sort of way that's managed.
Yeah, but aren't the shooters trying to avoid animal welfare concerns there?
That's right. And
they don't want to shoot does.
Also, they don't get as much meat for your time, and they're having viability problems now, and they've obviously got major market problems as well. So I would really like to see the macropod industry thriving, but it doesn't actually have any impact on the roo populations. So we are finding on this property that not having any shooting, the kangaroo populations, as I said, are tending to get back into the old mob structure, and we have less of them. Now, I don't know. So I'd like to follow this up with Ewan maybe at a later time, but we've done it for 5 years now. I'm not prepared to say it's being a success, but I'm getting more and more hopeful as years go by because...
But you'd have to hold your nerve taking that strategy, Stuart, wouldn't you, while you're watching kangaroos eat out your pasture, to just think, we're just going to sit here.
We started from a low base because by the end of 2009 we had 9 years of particularly low rainfall, so a lot of them had died or moved anyway, so we're starting from there. But since then, we've had one wetter season on record, another very wet season following. We then had a real dry last year where you would have expected the populations to move in, and they didn't. So they're out there now, but they're certainly not in the droves that we've seen in the past. So, and other properties are doing the same thing, haven't had shooters. And by the sort of collapse of the macropod industry anyway, it's been forced on a lot of people. They just aren't the roo shooters around anymore because they haven't got the market. So it is happening in a natural sense anyway. So it will be interesting to see what develops over the next few years in that that area.
We've had a similar story in the past of a property in near the Territory South Australian border where they're allowing dingoes to re-establish in their traditional pack structure, if you like, or the traditional numbers. I guess the same argument there. And I know it's quite controversial. Ewan, how hard do you think it is to convince farmers and graziers to go down the path that Stuart's taken?
Oh, look, it's particularly difficult, and I think we've got to do a much better job of supporting people to do that. So we've got to look at different solutions. So I think that the problem is we're stuck in this vicious cycle. We control dingoes, and then we get more wild dogs and more hybridisation, and there's no question they can impact livestock. But what we do know, again, is when you leave dingoes alone, they'll keep those kangaroo numbers down for you. So we're in this vicious cycle where we basically bait and we shoot dingoes, and then we end up with the dogs that we don't want, and then we end up with more kangaroos, and we just continue the cycle over and over again.
So, is it because we look at each pest animal individually?
Absolutely. So people often refer to what's called integrated pest management. So what that means is basically that when we look at whether it be a paddock, whether it be a national park, species are interacting with each other. So when you take out dingoes, of course, you may have more cats and more foxes and more kangaroos. So what we need to start doing is actually managing all species together. And that can be done, but again, it needs to be prioritised. So I think there's really, big potential wins if we can actually sort of move past, I think, a polarised view that dingoes are always bad or dingoes are always good, and actually start bringing in some new technologies as well and new approaches such as guardian animals, fences at small scales, I think, potentially, yes. I agree completely with Stuart that if we can have a viable kangaroo industry, that'll make a big difference as well. So there's a range of things we can do, but I think we've actually got to try some new things as well rather than just resorting to the old.
Yeah, so it's such a complex and challenging issue, isn't it? Stuart, just before I let you go, we're about to hear from a bloke in Victoria who's been collecting traps for the best part of 20 years. I'm not sure if he has a kangaroo trap. Do they exist, roo traps?
No, not that I'm aware.
Ewan, have you ever come across one?
I haven't heard of traps designed specifically for kangaroos, no.
No, okay, neither have I, so that makes three of us.
There's been quite a few caught in dingo traps over the years, but...
quite a lot.
Yeah.
Yes, when they tend to keep moving, but with the trap hanging off, but they're not,
They tend to get broken legs.
An animal you'd want to try and trap, even in a yard or something. You can imagine it'd just be terrible.
Surely you don't want that.
Yeah, mess. I just before you go, that I didn't make the point earlier. We never had a kangaroo plague here until 1980. So the previous 50 years, where we did control dingoes and we did have normal stocking rates and all the normal waters and everything else. We never had a plague. The first plague came 10 years after we had roo shooters come in.
Okay, so you draw your conclusions from there. Stuart, all the best with things, with your efforts. Talk again down the track. Thanks for joining us today.
No worries.
Stuart McKenzie, who is on a property that's in a fairly dry part of Queensland at the moment, not far from Charleville, just to the west of Charleville. And Ewan Ritchie. Ewan, always nice to have you on the program. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot, Cameron.
Dr. Ewan Ritchie, who's an ecologist from Deakin University. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. Well, we're just mentioning traps there because Daryl Walsgott is a Western Victorian farmer who's been collecting rabbit and dingo traps for two decades now. He's actually managed to get his hands on hundreds of them over the years. Ill health has prompted him to bring his collecting days to an end. So Brett Worthington visited his Pomonal property as he prepares to put more than 600 traps up for auction.
Oh, I think some of these earlier traps here, cage-type traps, the tambuers that you used to put them in the mouth of the burrow, in the same way traps work nowadays, the ones that you can buy. These would be about a bit over 100 years old, I suppose, the tambour, so there's nothing new under the sun as far as that's concerned. There's these other two here. Yeah, my name's Daryl Walsgott, and we're just having a look at my trap collection and rabbit paraphernalia, and it's all coming up for auction.
So we're at your property here in the Grampians, but you used to be a farmer at Beulah. So where did all this collection come from?
Well, it started off when my cousin was an executive of his estate, and he's a clearing sale there. There's a whole lot of traps there, and one of my cousins went through them and picked out the ones that were different to each other, and there's about a dozen there, and I decided, oh, this looks interesting, so I bought them. And that's where it all started.
You've collected a lot then in the next 20 years.
Oh, yes. I know, we've got fair dinkum about it.
So what was it about it that attracted your interest? Because you've written books about it since. Like, you've obviously got heavily involved in this collection.
Well, I suppose it was just, just another interest. I suppose it got a historical value because a lot of people only survived the 30s and the drought years because of rabbits. There was 120 million rabbits exported as skin or meat in the 1948, 49, yeah. These particular ones we're looking at here, they were made for wild dogs, dingoes, or whatever you like to call them. And you'd set them, and they've got they work in different ways. This one, the catch that holds the plate up in the set position, is held by the jaw. In this one, the plate goes, you put the jaws down, this clip goes over it, then the plate hooks onto it. Then when the animal comes and puts his foot on the plate, it releases the catch and the jaws come up and hopefully he's caught. In this part here, we're looking at fumigation gear. This one's a carbon monoxide fumigator. You put leaves and stuff in there, create a smoke, and then you've got the handle on the fan on the end, which pushes the carbon monoxide down the burrow. This one over here is another one. The poison comes as a cyanogas in a tablet form. You put the tablet in here and just wind the handle, and it forces the smoke down or the powder down into the burrow.
Is there, obviously, amongst all this, is there a favourite few pieces that stick out to you from that you've collected?
Oh, I suppose there's a number 21 here. That's a very rare trap. There's only a couple of them known. It's not only rare on an Australian account, it's also one that's suitable for American collectors too, because it came from America, and a lot of collectors over there collect Newhouse, Oneida traps. So it's all part of their history too. That's probably one of the best traps I've got here, I think.
And you're heavily in the packing up phase. Things are set to go away. What made you decide to just put it up for sale?
Health problems.
We're looking at one. It's got a plate on it, which must be about 20 centimetres long and about 30 centimetres wide, and big round clamps that have kind of got teeth on them. Safe to say this isn't just for your rabbit, this trap?
No, well, we refer to them as man traps because it came from England. There was nothing in England big enough to warrant that size trap, but the English manufacturers did make traps for lions and tigers and, you know, that bigger type of animal.
And so when they would have been setting it, would have been, I guess, to stop people from looting back in the day?
Well, it was to discourage poachers. The landlords or the landowners didn't like poachers coming in and spoiling their little block of land because they had nothing to shoot at then if the poachers got too many.
Well, this is arguably the biggest trap that I've ever seen, but I've just spotted what I think is potentially the smallest trap I've ever seen. It's clipped onto your hat here.
Oh, yeah.
Talk us through these traps that are on your hat.
That's called a Broken Hill mosquito trap, and this one here is it's another mosquito trap. They're souvenir-type things. Little one here, they call that a mosquito trap, but they had one for every state of Australia, and probably every town of the town wanted them. This hair here, that's just I suppose you call it a lapel badge or something, wouldn't you?
Well, it's a well-weathered hat, and it's got a couple of traps and a hair on it, so yeah. It's it obviously completes the collection. Where we are up in this bit of your shed here, up the top here, there's the boards with the screws in. Obviously, the traps all used to hang up in here, I assume.
That's right. Yes, they used to.
How does it feel when you look and you see that they're all empty now?
Doesn't worry me particularly. No. All good things come to an end, I suppose, don't they?
Whoa, Pomonal trap collector. Daryl Boscott from Western Victoria speaking there to Brett Worthington. That auction's on at Matoa, which is northeast of Horsham, on July 27. This is Bush Telegraph.
Listening is a peaceful act. Listening to the silence, but more than that, listening to the other.
The thing is also that peace is around us all the time. It's here. It's just that we haven't tapped into it because violence and war is actually what the habits of our cultures are.
Vim Vendors and Mary Zanazi are inventing peace. That's Radiotonic, Sundays at 3, here on RN.
Baby boomers have become a bit of a whipping boy and whipping girl of Australia lately. They get blamed for clogging up the roads in their caravans and for driving house prices up around the cities. All sorts of things are attributed to baby boomers these days. We'll tell you what's good about them for regional Australia, why some baby boomers have even been dubbed super boomers, because they could revitalise the region. So stay with us for that. That's coming up very soon. First, though, Kath McAloon joins me today for Rural News. Kath, it's got to be all about the carbon repeal, hasn't it?
It has. It was big news yesterday, I guess, after a sort of drawn out, wasn't it, the eventual repeal
sort of
the tax?
I'll say.
Well, many farmers, and particularly some of the big rural businesses, were not fans of the carbon tax, so no surprise that some of those were applauding yesterday's Senate vote that finally saw it abolished. The dairy and meat processing industries have welcomed the repeal of the carbon tax. They say it'll allow them to become more competitive internationally. Beef processor Tees Australia says it'll save $5 million a year now that the tax has been scrapped.
In their energy bill?
Mm.
$5 million.
Yeah. The general manager of corporate services is Tom McGuire, and he says he hopes the savings could be passed on to beef producers.
Our mission is to get our total manufacturing costs as low as possible. That's our duty, because there's two things we can do, and only two things. Get more for the meat that we sell. So we try and sell our product all around the world, and we keep our costs as low as we possibly can, and that's our responsibility to cattle producers.
And the Australian Dairy Industry Council has also welcomed the repeal. It was saying that the carbon tax was costing the average dairy farmer up to $7,000 a year. The president of Australian Dairy Farmers, Noel Campbell, says that the industry takes climate change seriously, and many dairy farmers are doing things on their farms to, take action.
About 40% of our use of power at the dairy shed is for hot water. And a lot of people are putting solar systems in. There's also lots of other mechanisms with respect to recovery of heat from refrigeration, etc., that can be used. So there's lots of new technologies that can be used, and hopefully farmers will take them up.
Okay, so generally the agriculture sector expecting some savings there. We had a bloke who grows cotton for a living on earlier in the week who said his power bill is $230,000 a year and expects to save about $20,000 off that. Just while we're on carbon, this weekend, background briefing, special guest reporter Paddy Manning, who's the business editor at Crikey, is looking at whether or not the government is pinning too much hope on clean coal technology. So if you've got an interest in all things climate related, you might want to tune into that at after the 8 a.m. news on Sunday morning. Now, just before we'll leave carbon there for a moment, Kath, because yesterday on the program we were talking about the push for cheeses to be made with raw milk again, the fact for Zants, the regulator, is taking submissions on that at the moment. I see there's a new centre to be opened here in Australia looking specifically at food safety issues.
Yeah, this centre, which will be based at Sydney University, will look particularly at fresh produce in Australia and any food safety concerns about those issues. And it's around, I guess, stopping some of those, you know, devastating contamination scares that have seen people die. It follows a number of health scares overseas where contaminated sprouts in Germany and toxic listeria on rock melon in the United States ended in the death of dozens of people. So they can be really serious, these contamination scares. And research hasn't been done looking particularly at the Australian context. So this centre will focus on some sort of Australian-specific issues. University of Sydney Associate Professor Robin McConkie says they'll look at gaps in research, including how Australian wild animals can contaminate vegetable crops.
And we know what pigs and birds do in Europe and in the United States, but what about our wildlife? If they tramp through a field of lettuce, are they likely to contaminate paddocks? We have different salmonellas to those in Europe and in the United States. So how do they survive in the soil? How long do they last? Are they pathogenic, and are they going to make us really ill?
Judging by the feedback we had yesterday on Twitter at RNBushTally, a lot of people will be interested in that. Thanks, Kath.
Thanks,
have a good weekend. Kath McAloon with today's Rural News. We hear a lot about declining country towns, the fact that young people just keep on leaving some areas. But there's another demographic change that's going on, an influx of older people packing up and leaving the city and moving to the country. It's, according to some, this is a group that might actually be the saviour for some rural towns. In fact, the Regional Australia Institute thinks they're having such a positive effect that it has actually labelled them super boomers. Sue McCluskey from the Regional Australia Institute will tell us more about that in just a moment. But first, Paul Tomlinson moved to Northam, from Perth quite a while back now. Paul, why did you make the move?
Cameron, very good morning to you, and it's interesting, your program's gone from kangaroos to bait to super boomers.
Yeah.
You know, an interesting sort of development there.
Well, cover all things here.
Why did I make the move? Well, the move was made initially for business reasons. We had business interests in the Avon Valley, and as a director of the company at the time, it was decided that one of us should reside here to keep a real hands-on on our business. It's turned out to be the best move that I personally have ever made. You know, it's just given me a complete rebirth.
How? What's it done for you?
Well, it's the quality of life here is so special. It's uncluttered. There's a great sense of dignity, a sense of values, a sense of belonging, and very importantly, a sense of being able to make a difference if that's what you want to do. But at the same time, if you just want to hide in the community, then the community don't judge you. You know, it's a fabulous place to live, and also a fabulous place for families to develop.
Mm. What about work and job opportunities? Are there many there?
Yes, there are. Yep. Mm. Our unemployment rate through this region is very low. Like most things in life, it's, you know, the opportunities are there, are what you make them, and we find here that opportunities create opportunities and synergies create synergies. It's, you know, it's a wonderful, positive environment, very much, glass half full.
Mm, okay, so you're clearly not regretting moving out of Perth by the sound of things.
Definitely not. No. I would cringe if I had to do the to work and home from work, you know, death-defying highway motor trip these days. My God, you know, you'd be stressed to the max before you started, and stress when you got home, you're hopeless.
That's Paul Tomlinson. Stay with us, Paul. I'll come back to you in a moment. But Sue McCluskey is the Chief Executive of the Regional Australia Institute. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Cameron. How are you?
Good. So you've come up with this term super boomer. Do we think Paul is a super boomer?
Oh, look, Paul certainly sounds like a super boomer, because to be a super boomer, you've actually got to be a baby boomer living in regional Australia and contributing positively to your regional community, and that exactly sounds like Paul.
What constitutes a positive contribution?
Well, it could be a whole range of things. You know, for some people it is remaining in the workforce, but it could be a different career to what they might have had in the city if they've moved from the city. It might be starting up their own business, running a cafe, for example. It might be volunteer work. You know,
so this is what's dubbed the encore career, is it?
Well, look, yes. You know, you can get encore careers where you actually, you know, move from perhaps the high-paced job you have before. You still want to remain actively in the workforce, but perhaps do something different.
Or you thought you retired and the kids keep hitting you up for money.
Or the other thing we see is that you do retire and you spend the kids' inheritance.
Yeah, I guess there's a bit of that going on as well at the moment. But in all seriousness, isn't one of the big issues in regional Australia that the population is ageing and ageing too fast? So I don't see how baby boomers gets you over that problem.
Well, look, it's true that the population is ageing, and that's why we thought we would have a look at what that profile was in regional Australia. But what we've got to remember is that there's actually two distinct groups. You know, when we talk about people over 50, you do have the younger aged, you know, the baby boomers, those between 50 and 69 years old, and the older age, people that are 70 years and older. And for those two groups, they actually have very different needs and expectations. And for that baby boomer group, they're actually healthier, wealthier, they're better educated, and they're more mobile than any other generation that has been heading into retirement. So we need to think quite differently that, you know, retirement is no longer dropping out of the workforce and dropping out of life. You can actually remain very active and dynamic contributors.
Mm. Paul, what's it been like, though, for people who say, move to Northam later in life, had a career and life elsewhere? Do you feel it's a community that accepts the influx, is happy to have the new residents?
Absolutely. In fact, very, very interested in what Sue had to say. I told you when I came here on business. I got involved very quickly in the community, and particularly in a fledgling not-for-profit organisation that was geared primarily to structuring an environment that kept our greatest asset, in other words, our kids here. We got involved in, and this was all purely voluntary stuff, we got involved in serious health improvements,
education improvements, workforce creation. The end result was this became my passion and my hobby, but my passion and my hobby became my life, and I ended up giving up my business interests purely to be involved in the opportunities that this organisation and others that we networked with could do. And the opportunities, as I mentioned before, have just been enormous. Now, for example, starting from a very simple little community group, we've now got a balance sheet in excess of $2 million. It doesn't sound much, but in relation to like organisations, that's not bad.
It's not insignificant either,
No, and we've been singularly responsible for injecting over $12 million of infrastructure improvements to the immediate region, and that's excluding another $18 million of capital improvements that industries that we've attracted into the area have expended, and also excludes an additional $4.5 million that we're about to leverage to build a workforce accommodation precinct in Northern.
So that's a different story than shops closing and people moving out, silos closing that we hear about from time to time.
We have a future that regional and rural Australia would die for. It is so positive. And if you think I'm putting it on, I'm being quite quiet about it, actually. It's something that I absolutely, I love. It's just fabulous.
Was your background in sales before you moved?
My background?
Yeah.
I was involved with the stock exchange at a young age. I had two real estate businesses. I owned a thoroughbred horse stud. Got involved in the media, and then here I am.
You had a dabble in a few different things.
Yeah.
So it sounds clearly there that Northam's an area that's seen this influx of super boomers that's contributed. But you've looked at why some regions are thriving in this area and others are not. Why do some do well and others not?
Well, look, first of all, that I think the story that Paul tells is just a fantastic story, and it's what we hear, and we'd like to hear more of them. So, Paul, love for you to contact us and give us your story, because, we think that example, one is what is already happening in other regions, but two is what can happen. And so one of our messages to the regions is look to embrace and encourage this to happen, because in actual fact, development in a region happens from the people itself and them taking the lead. But when we look around the country, of course, we've got to look at, what different regions have in terms of their profile. We see some regions that have what we call ageing in place. So they have people who have lived there, all or most of their lives and are getting older. And then we see ageing migration, so people actually moving to those regions. And, of course, Northam, is somewhere that's not that far from Perth. So it's something that
that time frame makes a difference.
Yes.
Is there...
I just add something to that?
Mm.
I don't think Northam's really much different to, to a lot of places. However, if there is a difference, the difference lies in this point. We decided that, and you don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to do this, change is always going to happen. Were we going to leave it to faceless bureaucrats in glass towers 100 k's away, or were we going to have some sort of steerage with a hand on the tiller? The latter happened. And as a consequence, we work very closely with government. And I have a very hackneyed bumper sticker saying, the tooth fairy ain't going to make it happen. If you want something to happen for your region, your locality, you've got to get off your backside and make it happen. And believe me, the opportunities do exist and are there for that to happen.
Mm. All right, well, that's a good positive note to leave things on. Thanks a lot, Paul. All the best.
Pleasure.
Paul Tomlinson, who's the Chief Executive of Avon Community Development Foundation in Northam. And Sue, all the best. Thanks for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
Sue McCluskey, Chief Executive Officer of the Regional Australia Institute. This is Bush Telegraph. Well, if you listen to RN's Saturday morning breakfast program, Country Breakfast, tomorrow morning, you might hear a few things that challenge your view about what actually goes on around rural Australia. It's the program's turning its attention to the luxurious side of life in rural Australia. Edwina Farley is the presenter of Country Breakfast. Ed, you're focusing on the glamour, are you?
Yeah, morning, Kemp. Look, it's not often that I get to talk luxury working in rural, so I couldn't really help myself. But it is quite interesting, you know, the things that sort of start out in the gritty rural environment and then end up in shops in Paris and New York and Milan. And I'm talking about fashion items, I suppose, but you know, everything from wool to leather to our jewellery has that potential. So it's just very interesting to sort of go back to where those things came from and also meet some of the people enjoying the end product, I suppose.
Okay, so everything that we see on the catwalks of Milan, you're tracing it all the way back to the paddocks of Australia, right?
Exactly right. And you know, it's
this is self-interest, isn't it?
Oh, totally. Yeah. Where is my Prada handbag? No, no, it is pretty interesting. And you know, we talk about the sort of profits for farmers and that end of things all the time, but we don't often sort of focus on what does the rest of the world think about Australia. And it's something that the editor of Vogue Australia thinks we should be doing a lot more of. Edwina McCann had some very interesting things to say to us this week when we asked her about Australia's connection with luxury.
I think Australians also need to start shifting our perception of luxury and understanding that we, for example, are the creators of the greatest luxury raw goods in the world, or some of them. We've got the best wool, clearly, merino wool. We've got some of the best cotton, some of the best leather, the finest croc skins in the world, the best South Sea pearls, the best pink diamonds or the only pink diamonds, you know, incredible yellow diamonds. I think we need to start understanding that we are in many ways the home of luxury goods when we talk about raw goods, and that we could create something in fashion, you know, Brand Australia, if you like, that was a trusted luxury goods home.
And if you think about it, Cam, we've sort of started doing that, especially in baby wear, for example, and I know this because I have three, but anything from, you know, pram snugs to baby wraps to, well, sport as well, you know, wool has kind of tapped into that market and stepped away from itchy granny's brown jumper to, you know, beautifully soft luxury products that everyone wants.
Which, that was the industry, or what the industry saw as one of its struggles for a while, wasn't it? That it had this image that it's something your nana knew with rather than something that was luxurious.
Definitely, and not something that your, you know, 18 to 30 year old is going to covet to have in their wardrobe. So it was a real shift and a mind shift to say, how do we make wool sexy? You know, how do we make it appealing and luxury item?
Okay, so you're looking at wool. Any other products?
Crocs, because apparently the happier the croc, the better the handbag. Who would have thought? But the less fighting and, you know, kerfuffle in the croc farm, the less damage to the skins, and so the bigger the premium and the greater the demand from some of the top handbag manufacturers. Now, I'm not personally going to spend $70,000 on a handbag, but people do, and it's Australian crocs walking around on that bag.
Are you serious? Is that really what you can pay for a European handbag?
Yes.
In the
tens
of thousands of dollars?
Absolutely. Hermes or Louis Vuitton or Prada, you know, there are multiple top fashion brands that come to Australia for our croc leather to turn into a handbag.
You could buy a house in some parts of rural Australia for $70,000.
Yeah, you bet. You could buy a luxury house in some parts of rural Australia. Yes, it's pretty staggering. But, you know, with those sorts of margins, you'd have to say our luxury exporters really, you know, could have a great future.
Yeah. Well, interesting program, Ed. So challenging a few ideas, you know, getting away from this idea that rural Australia is all about getting dirty and hard work and sweat. And
that's right. Away from the laid-back surfer outback dust fly thing to the, you know, ultra premium luxury must have items in Europe.
All right, a few reasons to get up early, hey, and listen to Country Breakfast. 6 a.m. tomorrow, or after the news at 6 a.m. I should
That's
say. Right. 3 till 7. You have a good weekend, Ed. Thanks
Terrific.
A lot.
Terrific. Thanks, Cam.
Edwina Farley, who presents Country Breakfast tomorrow morning on RN. This is Bush Telegraph, or that is Bush Telegraph, I should say. That's us done for today and for the week. My thanks to the entire team. The executive producer is Rowan Reed. Producers are Belinda Tromp, Kathy Pryor, Orsa Walquist and Verica Jokic. And technical production this week by Matthew Crawford, Matthew Sigley and Brendan O'Neill. Make sure you join us on Monday, a special program looking at the debate that's happening at the moment around the sort of rules and laws that could be put in place in Australia that will dictate what actions animal welfare activists can take on farms. So we'll delve right into this issue in great detail on Monday. Join us then. Have a good weekend. Cameron Wilson's my name. See you Monday.
Head backstage of one of the great global musical blockbusters, The Lion King.
The show is in different languages depending on where it's set.
Hear what drives the actors night after night to give it their all.
Well, I've been with the show for 12 years now.
Take a sneak peek and see how the intricate puppets are made.
A great puppeteer can make anything come alive.
The $5 billion industry that's Disney's The Lion King.
Somehow I ended up auditioning and I got the gig.
Into the music, anytime at the RN website.